fetch a silver seed to a new home in the sun.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio Hour 2 with our guest Nigel Kerner. His book is Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, the Conspiracy to Genetically Tamper with Humanity. And in this hour, I guess we'll get into maybe some of the biochemical DNA tampering that's gone on. Evidence is in the genome, people, Earth explorers. It's not just a rumor and conjecture. The biochemical tape is there, and we're reading it. Welcome back.
Well, this we have here in my company, Dr. John Biggerstaff, who works out of Tennessee University. He's one of your captures, you know.
The brain drain, they call it.
And Dr. Andrew Silverman is the other honcho with me here.
All right, I've got it. I got the names written down. I love UT. I graduated from Tennessee Technological University over in Cookeville, Tennessee, not far away. So we love the Tennessee campuses, great schools. All right, so we have before us a plethora of evidence that goes back, you know, to cave drawings and before. But we also have a biochemical record that's been left anthropologically in beings that we have exhumed that have been fairly well preserved. And what we see in the record is that there are sudden and massive changes in the genome which could not have been natural. They had to be manipulated. And that means that other beings have been on this planet capable of doing this kind of work, which is not really a big stretch. We're doing it now between cabbages and jellyfish and human beings and corn. It will be done as we progress in our scientific ability, and it has been done in the past, which is quite stunning. And I'd like to kind of go into that a little bit. What did you find as you began researching this and putting it into this fine publication? Did I lose everybody, or is everybody still there?
Hello?
Yes, I'm still there.
Are you
hearing me?
Hello?
Oh, boy. I don't know what happened. I've got a signal going, and is it going out? Are you hearing me?
Well, we can't tell you if you're not receiving us. Hello?
I can hear you.
All right, great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay.
All right, well, it's the wonder of live internet radio. You never know what's going to happen. Sometimes the internet does its own thing. We have in the record, in the genomic record, evidence of tampering. And at least it's reasonable to assume that that tampering never stopped. Has the game changed at all? Are they still about the same program they were 200,000 years ago? Are they doing something different than they were 50 years ago? Oh, boy. For some reason, they're not hearing me. I don't know what happened.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'm asking a question, but nobody's responding, so I didn't know if you were hearing me or not.
Yeah, my interest in all of this as a biologist came when I read Nigel's first book and he started mentioning some of this purported evidence for genetic manipulation, etc. And what I'd like to do is really go through from his thesis, really, of what human beings are. And really he's alluded to or explained really that consciousness, what is us, is really a gradually devolving effect throughout the chaotic milieu as it progresses towards the other pole of existence, if you like. And thus we are as human beings, and our sentience is really from the origin itself. Now, during some of this time, as we become more and more, you know, as we devolve, we need essentially prosthetics for functions which we would have originally been able to do, such as communicate with each other, etc., through, you know, more symmetrical resonance fields. As things get more chaotic, we need to invent technologies to be able to replace those functions. Now, obviously, the end conclusion of this is that we're going to make artificial intelligences, but we're going to make those out of atoms themselves. And so they have no reference frame really back to the origin of this. But seeing that we can, for instance, we can come back again and we still retain our original integrity to be able to move into atoms and actually continue our lives, really, I mean, this is a for them, it's an incredibly enticing function, even though the principle is beyond their fundamental understanding, since they are just made of atoms. And so really what they do is they'll in Nigel's thesis, what they've done is to taken people, if you like, or hominids, which have devolved down to the state where effectively their soul, if you like, as Nigel called it, really is capturable in a sense. But in order for them to actually progress their existence, the thesis is that really they've got to try and piggyback onto us and manipulate us so that we're more like them in some ways, so effectively they can continue their existence using the same mechanism that we use.
So they're turning us more into a machine.
That's right.
And them more into living things.
Absolutely.
Have you noticed how much the world is becoming much more systemic and machine-like, even in terms of what they ask us as human beings to be, if you see what I'm trying to say?
Sure.
And there's a huge change that's going towards this all the time. No one notices it, you see. This is the problem, Brooks. We all take it as the day's own troubles as we go along, and our own sweet way, you know, interested in all the things that we as human beings have to cope with. And little by little, the changes are coming in that make us lose the component of us that makes us something very special and actually have a way of gaining an eternal scale of reference. They, by interposing their kind of mechanism on us, as Dr. Bickerstaff will tell you, they then interfere with this. And this is a great thing. They, I believe, are taking away the possibility for some of us to have an eternal scale of existence. And that is probably the biggest thing that we can lose.
Now, one of the points here is that it takes if we do genetic experiments, for instance, we have to wait for generations of animals or fish or bacteria to actually pass. If they're going to mess with human beings, they've got to effectively adjust or take into account the relative lifespan to see whether or not these genetic changes are going to generate any aberrant effects or whether they're actually going to run true to what it is the intention of the Greys is to actually be able to hijack and piggyback onto our DNA. And I think what originally happened and what Nigel is hypothesizing is that from the sort of out of Africa experience, you know, I mean, there really is an argument for, I mean, Africa at that time was in fact a very nice place to live, and why really sort of all wander off in different directions. But if one were setting up an experiment as a scientist, for instance, one might genetically manipulate a population, take groups of individuals, put them in different places and culture them like we do bacteria, etc., so that you can actually see what those effects are and which of these populations is actually going to generate the qualities that you actually want to propagate, to actually hijack and piggyback onto. And I think perhaps, you know, these abductions, etc., maybe just in some ways that they're actually picking up people, having a look at them to see whether or not these human beings are actually conforming to their program, or even to try and find out where people are not conforming. And Nigel is postulating that may be more the case. Why are they not conforming, and are they, you know, relevant to the continued experiment, or shall they move on to another part of the population? I think the other part of this is, in terms of this piggyback experience, that what these aliens are doing is, in fact, now more and more actually genetically intercepting human beings so that their progeny, the babies, there are lots of reports of people being presented with their babies to look at the maternal effect, etc. But really, you know, I think they're trying to get closer and closer to where they can actually put their hybrids, if you like, within our own population. And I think quite a few people have actually postulated that in the past.
Yeah, I don't doubt that there are probably hybrids walking among us. Sometimes you see them at the mall. It's not that difficult to believe.
The problem with that is we all have our subjective view of what a hybrid should be. Yeah. And sometimes we include our family in there, don't we?
Or ourselves. In historical Earth, when the population of man was very light and there were Neanderthals and Cro-Mags on the Earth, it was easy to isolate populations. You could pick up a couple hundred souls. You could manipulate their offspring, make sure that they were mature, and then drop them into a fairly isolated place. We didn't have trains. We didn't travel. We stayed pretty much in the climes where we grew up and died. And
that's the interesting thing, you see, Brooke, is why did the population from this wonderful benign climate in Africa be suddenly transported to northern climes? Why were they taken there? Now, there is something, a clue to this in the book I try to offer as an explanation, because top geneticists cannot understand why we'd go into a stressful situation from a situation where everything was much easier to, in fact, promulgate life, living, and the pursuit of whatever contentment they were capable of getting at the time. And so this is the problem, is why were we isolated and put in different parts of the world? I think it's part of a genetic experiment they were doing, because there were certain types of hominid they, for physical reasons, their technology couldn't actually change. And they only chose a derivational type of hominid which they could do this to. If that's the case, then they have a favored type of hominid they're using. There's an example that sent a chill through me when I read it, because obviously, I mean, I was only born at the end of the war, so to speak, but This German dictator Hitler was supposed to have presented to his cartel of devils, whatever you might call these things, this the new man. And there it was, this kind of artifact human being that he said was going to be the future man. And it is a crazy situation, but many of this type of man is described by abductees and people who've had you know, experience of these encounters with these greys as being within the kind of disposition of their ships or whatever it is that they use to move around in and so on. And the same type of man, the same features and so on. And I think that this kind of business is being perfected, you know, to the point where none of us will be able to tell the difference. Because if we can, you know how sensitive human beings are, you know, the slightest change of skin tone, and we are suspicious of people. It'll be the size of noses next or whatever, and we will notice it, if you see what I mean. We're all kind of engendered on the human face and features, so they would have to get in something that is possible and something that is attractive to us all. And so therefore, you know, it's easy to be paranoid about this and can construct all kinds of paradigms. I know that. But, you know, we really have to be able to get to terms with this, because one thing is absolutely certain from my point of view through my research, and that is that they're here. They got here past the Einsteinian ceiling speed business. They have the most amazing capacities as described by experienced people. You know, they've been seen doing almost 90-degree turns at 25,000 miles an hour, whatever. They have a prodigious technology. Now, I tell you what, if anyone has a greater technology than anyone else, what happens is you start to dominate. And in the scenario of the second law of thermodynamics, things get worse, not better. So there must be something about us that we can use to continue. And I think that we have that because we don't die. We come back again. Reincarnation was accepted by every single religion in the world at one point. And for various reasons, usually reasons based upon the power of a small cartel of people within each systemic, you know, arrangement of religion. And these people then went there and said, look, we give you the power by waving our arms or throwing water on you or whatever to go into heaven and that kind of nonsense. Well, I tell you what, maybe they, without realizing, were acting under the instigation of something that was selecting all the time.
Yes,
well, what about the rest of us who have this capacity for eternal life?
The idea that we have eternal life, I think, is irrefutable. It goes through every bit of writing, every bit of song, every bit of thinking that we have. And the ability to literally transcend prison, war, slavery, everything, with that ability to come back over and over again eternally if we wish.
The problem is that we come back to diminishing returns, you see. The earth, as we come back, is the disposition is always worse going forward in time. That's the problem. We have to try, it seems to me, to gain a scale that's beyond the return into physical universes of diminishing returns.
Well,
where the second law of
thermodynamics
works.
But I understand that.
We've got to get into the Godverse, is what I'm trying to say.
I understand that, but you have to understand, or at least I try to understand, that the soul is actually gaining experience with each one of these incarnations, and if they can just remember that experience and bring that wisdom forward with them, then true, the physical or
you're right,
you know,
Brooks,
devolves, but the actual soul might become even more powerful and more benevolent and more
you
wise.
You bet. Absolutely right. But just think about this. As long as you've got control to see who I am and make decisions freely with free will, that's fine. How about a situation where a contrived creature can put in you, and I wrote an article some time ago called SIM Card Man, where they install in you some kind of device that prevents you doing this, where you do not know yourself anymore, as a kind of derivational scope towards matching their prescriptions of being, so to speak. If you can take away from a human being that capacity, we are in big trouble. So we come back, shall we say, after death, to a world where this is the norm. We have no way around this.
Why don't we choose another world to reincarnate on? If this one
that's quite right. We might do, but the fact that we reincarnate or whatever it is based upon, I think, an attachment to things undone. And I think if you've got a harmonic, finally, that harmonic must be met in every kind of prescription possible. And the problem with that is that if you can't meet the harmonic, you are stuck. And that's the problem. They call it karma in the old Indian types of philosophy and so forth. It's a very profound, and if people want to read about it, it's a very profound and very, very clever way of looking at things.
We're just a naturally nonconformant intelligence. You know, our consciousness gets involved in our genes making the proteins that support the human body. And maybe we would resist any kind of conforming biological or even electrobiological way of controlling the human soul. The human soul will transcend that.
And well, ask the doctor if that might be possible.
Hi, Andrew Silverman here. I was just going to say, if we place this into universal context, and if you look at the history of the universe, it began in a state that was altogether a singularity. If Schrödinger was right, that our natural status as sentient beings is all one, and yet we've become separate. Now, how does that follow in terms of the second law of thermodynamics? And logic and reason suggests that the more you separate, the more you restrict, the more you divide, ignorance begets ignorance, that actually you get a vicious circle beginning, that the less you know, the less you understand, the more you fear, the more you separate, the more you become stuck in this idea of self and ego and so on. It becomes a vicious circle, and each time, rather than becoming wiser, we're more likely to become more ignorant. Now, if the universe is ending in a heat death, then if we're sticking around in this physical universe, perhaps there's another way. And this is where, if we're talking about science and scientific evidence, I'm absolutely fascinated by a particular object that exists, which is actually one of the objects in the world that has been studied the most in all of human history. And that's something called the Turin Shroud. Now, many listeners might think, oh, yes, well, of course, that was shown 20 years ago to be a fake. But actually, there's been some wonderful work that was done by, for example, Benford and Marino, in their work that showed that the carbon dating was actually done by was actually done on a part of the cloth that was sewn in later by the nun. So we'll come to this later in the last hour of the program. But there's a lot of evidence, if you look at this cloth, that suggests that humankind has a capacity to actually escape beyond this physical universe to an eternal existence, but that if we stay within it, that we will tend to become...
Try not to be religious about this. I mean, we've had long discussions, my colleagues and I, over this, and come to a kind of understanding about this that we think we can hitch up logically. Dr. Bickerstaff will probably take you through to answer directly how they might do this. But your question was, can we resist this kind of mechanistic input with the power of our spirits and our soul? Of course, it may not be able to influence intrinsically that capacity within us. But what it can do is actually stop it making progress, because while it is inserted, while, shall we say, a SIM card might be inserted into us with a needle or whatever it is, through some system that they might contrive, shall we say, you can't go to hospital unless you get this, that, or the other. They make laws or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, that
they do with farm animals now. Society, it won't be
we
long.
Have a big problem. Yeah, sorry, we have a big problem here because we have to follow, you know, what our governments tell us. And supposing that such a thing, such a proposition does take shape, we then have a problem about how do we control us, me, if you like, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Sure,
how
yeah.
do we resist this? And that's the big problem I'm worried about, that maybe these things have such an influence over a small cartel of very powerful people who make the running within our societies, and then you and me and our children become victims of something that is absolutely draconian. And if you really want to know how they can do this, we've been discussing how this with Dr. Bickerstaff, who is a biochemist and so on. Maybe he's got some interesting idea on this.
Yeah, I think in order to understand how they are going to actually hijack and actually influence the way we think, we need to just add a few more facts, really, to define. We've gone through the principle of what really our continuing part is. We know that can interact with atoms in order to work with karmic effects, etc. The big problem is, well, how does it do it? And really, some pioneering work has been done by one of Penrose's colleagues, Stuart Hameroff, in Arizona State, where he was really examining sort of what is consciousness, etc. And really one of the conclusions that they've come up with is really that there is some sort of effective quantum field, if you like, which we can analogize to this soul concept, which is able to interact with the atomic frame through little structures in our cells called microtubules. And what they postulate is that you get this interaction, which generates effectively some coherent effect, which interacts with really our body water. And, you know, a lot of our biochemistry, we really consider the balls and sticks of molecules that actually interact with each other, and we pay little heed to the solvent that that these molecules are actually in. And water is quite a profound substance in many ways. And what they found is that this effect from essentially one side of the atom, if you like, to the other, can be propagated into really structured holographic electrical potentials or electric fields. And it's really those which are switching on and off the DNA in our bodies, etc. It's really being driven by one's consciousness itself through into the atomic system. And really, when you come to that idea, rather than a sort of evolutionary paradigm that the genes are actually controlling everything, in fact, again, if one looks at recent articles where one tries to correlate a genetic effect to, for instance, disease or a propensity towards behavioral anomalies, we have a real problem, because there's only about a 10% correlation. And this really supports the idea that really the genes are effector systems of some master system which is actually controlling them. Now, once one has such an idea, and there are quite a lot of publications that one can use to defend such an idea as that, and I'm an adherent of such an idea. What actually happened sort of back in the day to try and, I mean, obviously, one's consciousness can control one's physical system, so how do you intercept such a thing? And really, one concept here is that we look to, you know, another structure within the cell called the mitochondrion, the actual powerhouse. And this powerhouse sort of endosymbiotically attached to us many millions ago, years ago. But the problem with this is that if we have, in fact, something which is according to the second law of thermodynamics, then one can't really evolve from a puddle through a set of molecules with some electric bolts to actually generate enough of this effect to get this spontaneous order occurring. And so Nigel's hypothesis in his book is that we have this devolving structure. Well, if we have devolving structures of thought mixed with the atomic process, really, how do you get the mitochondria in the first place to put it? You'd have to get something to actually put them in you, rather than this endosymbiotic function. And so Nigel's postulate here, really, and again, I would agree with this, is that, you know, this would be an absolutely wonderful way of putting extra genetic material and energy transfer systems, electron transfer systems, into the cell. Now, since we've got an electrical system there already, if you like, in terms of this holographic electric field, which even Pribram has postulated as the way our brain works, etc. So again, there's quite a lot of evidence for this. If you start putting extra systems in there, which, you know, if one looks at the membrane potential of a mitochondrion, it can be over 100 millivolts, which is actually far higher than the cell membrane potential itself, then these electric fields are going to be disrupted. And so what we're finding more and more now is it's not so much the primary genetic code, the primary sequence of our DNA, which is important. Of course, it is important for making the sequences of the proteins. But in fact, that more things like psychological qualities, all of these different, than the ways in which different genes are switched on and switched off, is more controlled from the conformation, the three-dimensional structure of that DNA. And in fact, I actually work on some parts of this myself. So really, changing the conformation, or the super coiled twisting of DNA can actually be very important there. But since that super coiling and twisting through our psychological qualities is controlled by an electrical paradigm from a quantum paradigm, if you like, then to interrupt that with things like mitochondria, which has its own DNA, one can clearly see that if one can manipulate the DNA of the mitochondria, then we can actually affect psychological profiles and genetic effects that are going to come from that.
And that's a wonderful way of getting into the nuclear DNA through this bacterium, you see,
sure,
that had to the mitochondria within bacterium. And that really is the key to all of this. I think this is how they started to alter species anyway in the first place. In other words, to create the larger brain, and commensurate with that, to actually create a pelvis that was able to admit the larger brain in African Eve, and create the hominids we know as Homo sapiens sapiens in the first place. So you see, these guys have a trick or two based upon their technological deductive thinkability, so to speak, you know, and really we have a big deal here. They can come past all the axiomatic forbiddances, like the speed of light problem and so on, and to this planet. And if they can come and do that, I tell you what, Brooks, they can control anything. They can switch off our nuclear security codes, whatever it is. We are in big trouble.
Well, and that's why
governments don't admit they're here, because they can't protect us. And that's a big deal. And I think the people of a great sense of veracity, you know, colonels and captains in the American services and so on, are really worried about this. These people have children. We have generations to come. We are just the, in a sense, we're not royalty, whatever. We're just the ordinary citizens of being, so to speak.
Well, if we become aware of this, and I would say that nation by nation, even village by village, we are becoming aware of it.
And programs like yours are actually doing a fantastic service, if I may compliment you, in at least trying to get this into the mainstream.
Right, yeah.
So when so many people run away from this, you know, within the mainstream, why is that? Now, that's a big question we've got to ask.
I'm not really sure why that is. Now, I have to tell you, I've watched shows like Larry King and I watch Fox News, and I got to tell you, about every 4, 5, 6 days, there's a pretty big piece on UFOs and the idea that we might be visited by other worlds. I'm sure History Channel, Discovery Channel, Science Channel has all kinds of documentaries on it. I think that generally,
but carefully examine them, and you will find a underlying sense of humor there.
Sure.
There's a kind of mockery, a skeptic nonsense put in there, whatever.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a program where people who can understand and done research into this have got together and actually presented their case?
Not in the mainstream. And I've seen it at various conferences.
You will not get it there, really.
But, you know, I found a perfect statement of purpose in the book. It says, the whole Gray Manifest is a search for the accomplishing of a means to a natural living process rather than continually manufacturing one as they have. They want a soul. Well, you know, they can't have one. And
you put your finger on it.
They could suppress ours. But
you have a wonderful mind, if I may compliment you on it, because that's a wonderful piece of perception there. And that's the thing that is the final paradox of all. Because as a machine, they will just go by the program.
Right.
I have no sense of acrimony towards these greys whatsoever. They are just simply doing what they're programmed to do.
Yes, exactly.
The big problem was you made a mistake making them in the first place like this. That's the big problem.
Well,
we are getting the bad side of it all. You see?
You know, I'm an engineer, so I'm always looking for solutions. And one of the things that is a quandary for us is they may be here, or they are here, maybe by the hundreds of thousands, maybe by the millions.
Yes.
Where are they? How do we round them up and ship them out?
Well, I read from your particular brief that you went looking for them somewhere, and you were heading in the right direction. I believe they have to hide within, you know, parts of the world that we don't normally go to. There was a recent thing, a ship off the coast of New Zealand was sailing its way through a rather large ship from all accounts, and this massive great wave began to form in front of it, and out of that wave came a huge ship or whatever this thing was and took off in front of all these people. And of course no one would believe the crew when they got back and said this is what they saw.
Right.
And that's the problem.
Yes.
You get this jokey kind of situation, you know, in the mainstream, and the vast majority of people are denied the seeing of or the verification of these things. And that's what I'm worried about. What lies beyond this consensus in the mainstream?
Well, if you look at the way that money is being spent and let's just look at particularly military. NASA's budget has continuously been shrunk. I think this year it was like $600 million. It's really ridiculous. But the national defense budget for the same year was $1.3 trillion.
Yes.
And, you know, my question is, you know, the uniformed soldier fighting U.S. armies, for instance, is a relic. It doesn't exist anymore. We are the dominant force in humanity on the planet. And hopefully we're a force for good, but that could be argued later.
Yes.
The question is, look at the weaponry. Look at the detection systems. Almost every other day, we are launching special satellites into space with the surveillance ability of looking at the Earth. Just Sunday, I talked about a bill that was in the House that would not allow the Pentagon access to imagery from satellites with sharper apertures than 1.5 meters. And we're launching satellites with sharper apertures all the way down to 1 meter, even less.
Yeah.
So if we're keeping that information from the Pentagon, who is getting that information?
You bet. That's the big $64,000 question.
Yeah, we are.
Who is powerful enough to do this?
Exactly.
And how powerful are they that they can contrive the keeping of evidence of this pervasive phenomenon that many hundreds of thousands of people are seeing and capturing with their video cameras and so on? You can just poo-poo anything that comes on a video camera and say it's been created in a studio. Short of getting these guys into a situation where they are verified by the President of the United States, China, or Soviet Union, and actually talking to the world and saying, here is Mr. Alien. There is no way you can get physical evidence out to the public. All you have to do is control the media, and the media can be easily controlled by black budgets all over the world.
Sure.
There's no question about that. So you and I, all that's left is this marvelous internet. But you asked a very important question that I'd like to get back to, if I may, because it really points in the direction of some kind of redemptiveness. Although I wasn't looking for it, I happened on it, and I saw this quite simply. And that comes from something that happened 2,000 years ago. Now, please understand me, Brooks. I have no sense of religion whatsoever. I simply hope I have a sense for the truth. And inasmuch as this is so, you asked a very important question. I think we kind of walked over all of this with it. We're trying to explain these things to you. But in fact, you ask a very important question. How do we resist this kind of tirade if it comes from a technology as great as this? Well, I believe that something happened 2,000 years ago. And remember, I am not a religious person when I see this. But looking at the evidence of the contrary to the gray phenomenon, so to speak, I began to realize that something that happened 2,000 years ago may in fact have the antidote to all of this. And Dr. Silverman, who is Jewish, will be able to explain this to you. And he has no reason to do this, by the way. He's not a Christian.
That's all right.
It's to do with the with this chap we call Jesus Christ, or Jeshua ben Yosef, to give him his real name.
Hamashiach.
Yeah. So he'll bring him. He'll explain something about this artifact that he left, called the Shroud of Turin. And in this, if you bear with us, is an incredible procedure and process that might point to what you and I and each one of us may have in potential to resist these greys. So,
yeah, I alluded to earlier about this, the Turin Shroud, and this is for. I just have to give a brief introduction about it for those of your listeners who don't know much about it. It's a 14-foot long piece of cloth that has an image on it of a man that has been known to where its whereabouts, at least for the past 700 years, and there's a lot of evidence to point to its whereabouts way beyond that, going back two millennia. Now, something very interesting happened back in 1898 when photography was first discovered, and someone called Secondo Pia took a photograph of the shroud, and when he saw the photographic negative of the shroud, he nearly fainted, because the photographic negative was a perfect positive. The shroud itself, the image on there, is a photographic negative. And it caused quite a stir at the time, and people thought this was a forgery, that his picture of it was a forgery, until in the 1930s it was photographed again, and of course the same thing was found. And scientists have studied this cloth, and I just want to get out of the way first of all, because a lot of people will be thinking about this carbon dating of 1988 and so on. Now, the thing about this is that it's been shown by careful study by textile experts and by a very world-renowned chemist who produced a paper in Thermochemica Acta, it's called, that actually showed that the part of the cloth that was dated in the carbon dating was actually a part of the cloth that was sewn in. It was a mixture of interweaving of a part of the cloth that was sewn in later by the nuns in the 16th century. And it was actually a combination of 16th century and 1st century cloth that was dated, hence the 14th century date.
Wow.
Now, and people can look this up for themselves. A wonderful research was initially done on this by Benford and Marino and Raymond Rogers, who was the chemist who was one of the original people in what was called the STIRP group, the Shroud of Turin Research Project, who once originally, when he heard the carbon dating, he was very angry when anyone tried to contradict it, because he was a man of science through and through. And he when he heard that there was an interweaving of part of the cloth that was added in later, he said, right, I'm going to prove them wrong very easily. And in trying to prove them wrong, he ended up proving them right. And before he died, he gave this interview saying that, you know, I wanted to disprove this, but they're absolutely right. The part that was dated was a much more recent cloth, and many scientists want more tests to be done, but unfortunately the Vatican aren't willing to release the samples for it to be done. But if we get back to the image on the shroud, now, it's only a surface phenomenon on the surface fibers of the cloth, no pigment involved. The only thing that's actually added to the cloth that forms part of the image has been shown to actually be human blood of a human male blood group AB, and that's what makes the blood stains on there. But the actual image of the cloth that shows in perfect anatomical detail the front and the back of the man, it was wrapped around the front and the back of a man who forensic pathologists have looked at the image and have shown that this particular individual with a Semitic appearance, he had been crucified, he had been whipped. And you can find all the details of all of everything that was done to him, the crown of thorns and the nails through the wrist, they're all there. Everything that points to this having been fitting with the specific historical characteristics that we associate with the historical character of Jesus. And botanists have looked at the cloth and found evidence from the pollen on it that it must have been in Jerusalem, in Judea, in the first century around March, April time, to have formed the patterns that it has on there. Now, this is a surface phenomenon, as I say, and the only consistent idea that the scientists who have studied it, and I recently went to and gave a talk at one of the international symposiums that have been held on the shroud. The one idea that they have behind how the image could have got there is there was a short, intense burst of radiant energy that came from the body of the man, the dead body of the man that was wrapped in the shroud, such that the surface image, which is less than a micron in thickness, actually contains distance-coded holographic information. It's the only photograph in existence that light photograph that has this this capacity, and we can't replicate it even with 21st century technology. We don't know how to make such a thing now. And what this suggests, and further studies on it have suggested, that actually when the image was formed, the body of the man was actually upright. He was actually vertical and suspended in the air, because the image of the hair is actually hanging down on the shoulders rather than behind, and the back of the body isn't compressed against the stone slab like it should have been if he was lying flat. What this suggests is that this dead body actually rose up from the slab where it was and actually shone brighter than the sun for a fraction of a nanosecond. And the only way you can actually make a similar change to linen that has been shown, has been reproduced, is using, they've done it with ultraviolet lasers. But that's just to make a spot on a cloth. You can't, to make the whole image, it would have to have been like laser light that was shining from his whole body. It had to have been from his body rather than reflected from his body to account for the distance coded effect. So the subject of my talk at this conference was, how did that happen? How does a dead body shine brighter than the sun. And is it just coincidence that there's so much evidence suggesting that the person who this phenomenon happened to be the one individual throughout the history of man who has had the most impact historically in suggesting a way of life that is congruent with going against what we're describing in terms of the entropic drift that separates. When he said, love thy neighbor as thyself, as Schrodinger himself pointed out, our neighbor is ourself. So we actually come from a singularity where we were all one, and yet our what people call sin, as Nigel points out, is simply restriction. It's simply us being less than we can be. And being less than we can be makes us different from each other, because we each have our own individual patterns of being less than we can be. And that's what makes individuality. That's what fosters separation and selfishness and so on. And these great teachers like the Buddha and Jesus and so on, they have always said is that all we need to do is to do the opposite of what the universe is doing. We have to bind together. We have
swim
to
upstream, as it were. And I like the idea, and I do. I have a good friend, William Henry, who also talks about Jesus becoming the light body. And this tremendous burst of energy is the transformation, the ascension of...
Mm-hmm. of the essential thing, though, if I may just interpose here, the essential thing is that through his words, if you can catalogue them as they're available, through his words, every single human being has the capacity to do this. And if we have the capacity to unscrew the hydrogen bonds in us and glow brighter than the sun, so to speak, we are something absolutely marvelous. And I can see why a machine can recognize this capacity.
Right, but it's never going to be able to master it. I mean, it might be able to suppress
that's
the
right,
body.
You're right. They will not do that. You're quite right. They will not be able to master, because they won't understand it, but they will be curious enough to try to seek it through their program.
And as Nigel points out, this story in the Gospels that Jesus was taken to a high point where he saw all the cities of the earth. You can do an experiment. The listeners can do this if they have a globe. Turn it round and you'll see that if you point it in a certain direction from one particular perspective, you can see virtually the whole of the landmass of what used to be Gondwanaland, if you like, Eurasia, Africa, the Americas, Australasia, can all be witnessed. And if you turn it around 180 degrees, then you see the Pacific. And where is the center of all of that landmass?
Egypt.
Well, it's not far from Judea. So if you go up in a straight line from there, from where Jesus was, that's where you can see the cities of the world from space.
And so therefore you imply from that Jesus Christ was probably taken by one of these things on the earth. And remember, it's reported to have said that he would give Jesus custody of the whole earth. The implication, of course, was that they owned the whole earth if he fell down and worshipped him. And in another statement, he said, you know, an incredible thing, you know, Jesus replied in a retort to him, get thee behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall not tempt the Son of Man. I think he was putting that machine being in its place and telling it that it was a machine. And as a machine, it was less than an insect.
No, interesting, if you look at the mythology surrounding this character, Satan or Shaitan, or called various different things in different cultures, but it's basically referred to as a creature that fell from the sky. Now, what is that? How can you have an opposite of God? If an opposite of God, there's no such thing, obviously, logically, as an opposite of God, but if as close to that as you can imagine, it's not going to be a sentient being, because to be sentient, if we're saying that sentience derives from this original state that we all came from of being all together and one, then it would have to be God to be sentient.
Absolutely.
So it fits much more, as Nigel suggests, that this was actually just a mechanical pseudo-intelligence. Yeah. What we call artificial intelligence is pseudo-intelligence because it has no sentience, it has no mind or awareness.
And that is our great triumph, that we have this over that entity with all its technological superiority and so forth. It itself doesn't know
that it is that. And I was rather curious as to why Jesus was not killed, or why he wasn't disposed of, if you like, talking like this to a person who claimed he had custody of the entire globe. Mm. And I think it's because a machine doesn't have a sense of revenge or vanity or whatever, that it was information to this being, that it was what it was. That was the status. And somehow, this individual, Yeshua ben Yosef, was able to communicate its own status in terms of an evolutionary paradigm. And so, because it was information, he was returned back. Mm. I don't know what might have happened to the individual he spoke to, whether he was called Satan or what, I don't know. But the fact is that that situation provided for me an insight into what the Greys might be. They simply are machines doing their business through a program. And because that is so, in one sense, they're extremely dangerous. And in another sense, we are superior to them. And the real business is, how do we convince all of us, the whole family of man, of the size of our nature and our property of being, so to speak? Now, I don't want to sound like some preacher or a teacher of new meanings. I really don't know what on earth that means. But, you know, in doing the research into all this business, these are the conclusions I came to. This verification, quite simply, Brooks, that we are something fantastic. And that would explain why a superior technology would persist on this planet for the length of time it has, to be able to acquire perhaps some of the propensities that we as beings have. Otherwise, I can't understand why something as superior as this in technology would spend 5 nanoseconds with us.
Well, that's true. I mean, although we are conscious beings, many of us, most of us, are not conscious that we're conscious.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we're and writing these books and speaking about this the way that we do on the air to get other people to listen, are trying to awaken those who are not conscious that they're conscious, so that they can realize that they are sovereign beings, eternal beings having a mortal experience.
I mean, as Jesus himself said, is it not written, you are gods? He was pointing to the immense, limitless potential of any and all human being.
Naturally derived living being. That's the most crucial difference.
We are
naturally derived living being from the Big Bang. We have a connection to the very start of it all. And that's what makes us extraordinarily special. And anyone out there in the universe, too, extraordinarily special if they've come through in this kind of fashion. And that's something we really need to remember, Brooks. And if you like, the whole story of this business of mine, you know, in writing these books and so on, is quite simply to tell, in great kind of surprise, really, what I have discovered, the size of our stature and how we as humanity do not really realize that we are something eternally scoped and not something temporarily to be disposed of in cruelty and wickedness and war and all the rest of it. And that is something I think somehow we've got to get to the public out there, and perhaps programs like yours and inventive minds like yours might be able to do.
Well, we are. There are points of light on the planet now, and we're able to communicate like never before. I mean, since 1996, really, we've been able to communicate with one another freely and unfettered as a planet, by and large.
You bet.
And the words of frustration that you quoted of Jesus from John 10:34, when he turned and snapped back at the Pharisees, "Is it not written, I said unto you, ye are gods, unto whom the gospel is given?" He's actually quoting Psalms from their own Old Testament.
Indeed.
So they already knew that existed, and they, in their day, suppressed that information so that they could maintain power over their own political dominion.
Yeah. And so, it's interesting that in a way you could see any sort of robotic artificial intelligence as an expert in logic, whereas Jesus was actually an expert in reason, going a bit deeper into it and saying, okay, you can use logic, you can make an atom bomb and so on, but where's it gonna take you? You have to start from the fundamentals of why are you there and what does your existence mean and so on. And interestingly, he actually said, when he was asked, what was he doing here? What was the purpose behind it? And he didn't say, I'm here to start a church, I'm here to start a religion, organization, and so on. He said quite simply, I'm here to bear witness to the truth. So in a sense, that's how he was actually, in a sense, associated with information in that sense, but in a living sense, and pointing to the size and grandeur of all sentient beings. Yeah.
And that's the important message to get through, I think, to us all. And I mean, I really didn't want to write any books about anything. I was actually doing an article on cricket when my son asked me the question. And it's really rather romantic thing, the way this all derived. And, you know, the last thing I wanted to know about was UFOs when I was writing an article on this noble game of cricket. Unfortunately, you Americans don't have any perception of how thoroughly wonderful this game really is, you know. I'm hoping that somehow someone will have some propaganda over there and bring that to you Americans, and then you will be truly civilized, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Oh, my goodness.
However, it bears saying that, you know, America, whatever anyone may say, is the greatest source of inspiration to the world. And in its beauty, it is the grandest place of all. And I'm saying that in terms of a British perspective. And I think anyone with any kind of sense of anything, seeing how our world has been saved by American interventions countless times and so on in the past, that it's something that is something we all have to take recognizance of. However, not so great in the recent past. And so sadly, I'm hoping that this kind of escape to the derivational scope of the second law of thermodynamics is not taking care of a place that has given so much to the world. And I'm not saying this because you're American or I'm speaking to an American audience. I think maybe that I'm probably more qualified to make the statement than any American is to do that, for obvious reasons. However, I hope they will stop and take a look at the leadership that they can have in the world, where this question of an interception by something out of this world, of the grand scale of power it might have, might be, if you like, in terms of our own sense of each other and so on. This is surely the point, not to hide this fact. It's the point to announce it to the world and say, look, let's get together and see what we can do. If we can understand what our scope might be as simple human beings, and communicate this in some kind of way to these interceptors that might be here who are machines, we may well have a chance in some kind of way of stopping whatever hidden agenda these things might have.
Well said.
And remember, this is the problem. They have an agenda, which I believe is in terms of their own resolutions of whatever thinkability they might have, not ours. We are lab rats, I am utterly convinced, of theirs through their technological inertias and so on.
Well, I think the thing that worries, you know, those of us that look at this question, is that not only do the Greys have an agenda, but we now really believe or suspect that this super government, this government inside governments, also has an agenda. We just need to figure out what it is.
And, yeah, but the problem is this. They may well be composed of hybridized beings that are acting to the auspices of the Greys. We may be able to draw that conclusion from the fact that they're ignoring what is simple derivational sense about that situation that says, if one of these things comes and has all this great technological power over us, why, and they are benign, why don't they declare it? Why don't they take our entire planet into a great and beautiful future? And by saying, look, here we are, we have all these wonderful senses, knowledge of all these wonderful things in the universe and so on. Join us and let's be a happy throng together. Oh, no.
they are hiding.
Yes,
something
they are.
There is in their hiding that points to something nefarious.
Well, let's see if we could shine a little light on it in our next hour. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio.